Good morning. Oh, that's better. So, my name is Francis. I'm from Hamilton. We just drove like for an hour to come. So I thank God for giving me a chance to worship with you today. My family is with me today, but they are not here. I think my wife is with my little girl. She is only 19 months old somewhere. And my son is already running around, so he's having a good time. So that's good. He's six, and he's running around. He's five. Since this is my first time here, let me tell you a little bit about myself. So I just came back from Vancouver a couple weeks ago. Although it wasn't my first time to the city, but it was the first time that I went there not as a tourist, but as a teacher. I spent 2 weeks there to teach an intensive course for a seminary. So as you can imagine, I have met quite a few new faces, like today. And when I introduce myself to the students, I usually go with something like, I'm studying and working at a seminary in Hamilton, a small town 1 hour west of Toronto. And when they ask me how small is Hamilton, I told them it's roughly 500,000 people. And most of them would just laugh after hearing that. They told me the entire metro Vancouver area has a population of 2 million people. So a town with 500,000, it's not quite a small town to them. My guess, I've lived in this side of Canada, in this eastern side of Canada for too long, compared to a city with, you know, how big it is, Toronto, how big Toronto is. It's like with roughly 5 to 5.5 million people. So compared to that, Hamilton is pretty small. But on the other hand, the Chinese population in Vancouver is almost the size of Hamilton. So, and as you can imagine, there isn't a lot of Chinese people in Hamilton. In fact, for a long time, most of my friends in Hamilton are not Chinese. And some of the fellow students in the seminaries are from the States. I want to tell you this one particular guy from a southern state, a place where it is not as multicultural as Toronto. I remember when I first met him, he is so fascinated by everything Chinese. My lunch, he would look at my lunch and ask me what that is. My snacks, at one time I have this waffle cookies. I don't know if you have those. Yeah, the waffle cookies, the Chinese brand waffle cookies. And he was like, can I have one? I said, yeah, sure, you can. And then he said, what do I do with that now? I said, pray and eat. Like he was thinking maybe he should dip it in something or whatever. I said, no, it's just cookie, eat it. And of course, my culture. So one day I was kind of surprised that he told me that I'm his second most favorite Chinese person. Second most. I asked, like, not the most, the second most? He said his most favorite Chinese is actually Bruce Lee. So, you see, even for those who have very little experience to Chinese culture, this martial artist, so who have not heard of Bruce Lee here, so everybody know who Bruce Lee is, or was. This guy is considered to be like quintessential Chinese, right? I heard that some people actually thought all Chinese know some martial arts or some kung fu moves, right? I don't know about you, like although I grew up watching martial arts movies and novels, I don't know even one kung fu move. I don't know about you, but I don't. So getting back to Bruce Lee, as famous as he is, like 10 years ago, if I asked you who's Bruce Lee's teacher, apart from the diehard martial art fans, I suspect most of us would not know the answer to that question, right? 10 years ago. But if I ask you now, maybe some of you are able to come up with the answer. So who knows who is Bruce Lee's teacher in martial art? Ip Man, right? Oh, Ip Man. It's a very difficult, like it's very difficult to pronounce that name. Some of my non-Chinese friends, they said, how do you pronounce a name without like a consonant in French? So it's Ip. I said, it's Ip Man. And he's a man, obviously, but that has nothing to do with that. The reason why Ip Man became more well-known these days are due to the fact that there are at least like five movies loosely based on his life released in the past 10 years. Or so, in all of them in Chinese, of course. And you, if you're into Chinese martial arts movies, you will notice that in most of these movies, Ip Man is portrayed as a hero. He was the best fighter. He was a patriot. he refuses to train the Japanese military police or soldiers during the Second Sino-Japanese War, like the Second World War. He defeated the Japanese general and also the Western boxing champion. He was a family man. He took care of his family when they first immigrated to Hong Kong, and so on. So he's a good guy. He's the hero of that story in most of the movies. But recently, like 2 years ago, another movie of Ip Man was released in Hong Kong and stirred up quite a controversy in Hong Kong. In fact, people claim that they have been tricked into the theater after viewing an action-packed trailer, but found that later in the theater that it's actually a drama film instead of like a martial art movie. So in this new movie, Ip Man is portrayed not so much as a hero, but one of the many martial art grandmasters who went through World War II and was forced to immigrate to Hong Kong. In this movie, he was still a good fighter, but he was not invincible. He was a patriot, but also suffered from the war. And in fact, both of his daughters died of starvation during the war. He was not quite a family man. He left his wife in China and failed his promise to visit her after he immigrated to Hong Kong. So after this movie, you'll find yourself asking the question, who is the real guy? Who is the real Ip Man? The best Kung Fu master ever, or the good husband, or the one that abandoned his family and a frequent visitor to the brothel? The hero or a commoner? This is the question we often have to ask ourselves when we read a story or go to a good movie. In fact, I'll go as far as saying that even in a biblical narrative, we are confronted with the same question. Now, think about most biblical characters that we are told to follow. Apart from Jesus, you can always find some shortcomings or some bad things of these characters. Sometimes we even found a portrayal mixed with good and bad episodes to a point that we don't know how to evaluate these characters. The portrayal of the characters that I want to talk about today is rather inconsistent, if not paradoxical, in the Gospel of John. Philip is described in four passages in John, although the author does not explicitly comment on him. But by way of the episodes that he chooses to include in his gospel, it's rather obvious by the end of this sermon that Philip is not generally portrayed as a very bright person. You know, you don't have to say it out loud in order to let people know your opinion regarding someone or something. Like, for example, one time I played in this soccer game with some of my friends, and as you can just take a look at me and know, I'm not a very sporty person. I've never good at any sport. But since my friends keep on asking me to go to their pickup games, so I went. And halfway during the game, I heard this conversation between two midfielders, one asking the other, on my team, hey, the guy asked the other guy, hey, you always play forward, but how come you're not taking care of offense today but become a defender? That other guy replied, how can I go forward today? Just look at these defenders. And you know where I was the whole night? I was a defender on the right side the whole night, just running around, avoiding the ball, actually. So just don't come to me, I was just running around. So you see, sometimes you don't have to say it out loud. You don't have to say, that guy sucks. A comment, a gesture, or even the facial expressions would do the job. So sometimes when I look at you guys, your facial expression would do the job. That's why when we look at the passages in John, when Philip is mentioned, if you read between the lines, you know John does not consider him as the brightest among the disciples. So let's take a look. If you have your Bible, please turn to John 6, 5-7. And I need to grab a Bible too, because I thought I have my PowerPoint, but I don't. Thank you. So John, the first or second passage of Philip is John 6. Philip 5-7, it says, "When Jesus looked up and saw a great crowd coming toward him, he said to Philip, 'Where should we buy bread for these people to eat?' He asked this only to test him." So notice, this is a test for Philip. "For he already had in mind what he was going to do. Philip answered him, 8 months' wages would not buy enough bread for such for each one to have a bite." So here, Philip, a guy you would definitely overlook even when reading through the list of Jesus' disciples. Oh, I was ahead of myself. Well, anyway, so we'll come back to this passage later. So this guy you would definitely overlook even when reading through the list of Jesus' disciples. If I asked you now to name the 12 disciples off the top of your head, who will you remember? Like, you have to come fast, because towards the end, you cannot come up with names. You will remember Peter, James, and John. Oh, that's the giveaways. Andrew. Now you know Philip, because we just talked about him. 5. Nathaniel.
Thomas.
Yeah, the bad guys. Yeah, okay. Yeah, it depends on what list you're reading. Yes, I'll give that to you. It's Nathaniel, the same guy. 3 more. There was one guy who wrote a gospel. Matthew. Okay, do we want to go on? 10 is good enough, right? 10 will give you a $500,000 question in the who wants to be a millionaire kind of question. You know, it's kind of hard, isn't it? I think not many of you memorize the list of names for the sake of piety or for the sake of like being super spiritual, right? If it's not like for who wants to be a millionaire, like kind of quiz for your Sunday school. I mean, remember all those names doesn't make you a good Christian, right? It may make you look smarter or like impress people with your good memory, so you're good. But I mean, look, we just don't have much things to record it in the Bible for some of these disciples. So if you don't remember some of them, it's not because you're not a good Christian, but because they just don't have anything for you to remember. It's just a name in a list. So if you don't remember them, some of them, it's okay. So coming back to Philip, I would say he is the least memorable disciples of all. Just think about it. Unlike the complete unknown, like Simon the Zealot or Judas the son of James, Philip is mentioned more than once in the gospel, apart from the name lists. But few of us can name any episode, apart from the one that we just read. Even he's mentioned 4 times in the Gospel of John. So to me, he is one of the most famous nobodies among Jesus' disciples, if I have to choose. He is definitely not a very bright guy, not even close to being smart or slick or anything like that. But he is on the same rank with guys like Peter, John, and James, those famous disciples. Let's look at these 4 passages in John and see where we can learn from these disciples. So the passages we just read, apart from the calling narratives, like the chapter 1 narratives that the sister just read for us, 3 more passages. The first one is 6:5-7, we just read. So here, this episode, like, is the feeding of 5,000, right? Philip is the obvious guy to ask for arrangement, as he is a native of the area. So from chapter 1 that we just heard, we know that he's from Bethsaida. John Cleary says here that it is a test for Philip. It's a test for Philip, a test for his faith, whether he believes Jesus is able to provide or not. But even after seeing all the miracles, remind you, this is the 6th chapter of John, right? So there are already quite a few miracles preceding this one. So even after seeing all these miracles before, he still cannot come up with a solution when presented a question or a problem. It is like Jesus is standing right in front of him, right? But what he sees is not Jesus, but the problem. So in a sense, it's like this problem is so big for him, it stands between him and Jesus. So him, the problem, Jesus. Whereas Jesus was hoping that he can recognize it is Jesus who stands between him and the problem. His faith in Jesus is rather limited, right? And he's rather slow to see the power of Jesus even after all these miracles. And 1 verse later, we see another disciple in verse 8, Andrew. Who knows that Jesus has the power to solve this and brought in the child with the fish and the bread. So this is Philip, little in faith and slow to recognize Jesus' power. The second episode, or third, it's on chapter 12, verse 20 to 22. Do you guys have Bibles in your hand? Yeah. Okay, cool. So if you have Bibles and you found a passage, chapter 12, verse 20 to 22, can we read it together? So 1, 2, 3. Among those who went. They said, "We would like to see Jesus." Philip went to tell Andrew. So I hope you see a pattern here. Here, some Greeks came to Philip with a request. Why they came to him instead of these other disciples, we don't know. Maybe it's due to his name, which is more common for a Greek name than a Jewish name. Or maybe he's from Galilee, which possibly has more Greek influence. So that's why these Gentiles came to him instead of the other disciples. But whatever reason behind this move, Philip was apparently perplexed when he's approached by these Gentiles, who not only ask him one time to introduce them to Jesus. They kept asking. If you know the language, the original language, it sort of described this consistent, kept on asking. They keep on asking Philip instead of just asking him one time. Kept asking him to lead them to Jesus. It's possible that Philip was torn between two possibilities. On one hand, he knows that Jesus, as a Jew, should not have interacted with the Gentiles. So we learned it from the Synoptic Gospel, from these other three Gospels, that Jesus don't usually hang out with the Gentiles. But on the other hand, these Greeks were really persistent in their requests, and he's afraid that if he would miss something really important if he does not bring them to Jesus. And at the end comes who again? Andrew. And at the end comes Andrew again. Like last time, he brings these Gentiles to Jesus. So Philip clearly does not have the same kind of determination in his character that Andrew has, right? And to make matter worse, after living with Jesus for 3 years, this is towards the end of Jesus' earthly ministry. This is chapter 12 of John. Mentoring under him for the whole time, for the whole 3 years, he still doesn't know his teacher all that well. So not only is he little faith, he also lacks determination. The last incident is John 14, 5 to 11, when Jesus is having his last words with his disciples before the Passion, predicting his suffering and resurrection. Jesus told them that he's going to prepare a place for them in the Father's house. Thomas, the scientist, the skeptic, asking on behalf of the disciples about the place that he is going, Jesus is going. So in verse 6, Jesus answers, "I'm the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. If you really knew me, you would know my Father as well. From now on, you do know him and have seen him." Philip was puzzled with this answer and naively asked. Philip said, "Lord, show us the Father, and that will be enough for us." Jesus answered, "Don't you know me, Philip? Even after I've been among you for such a long time, anyone who has seen me has seen the Father," which Jesus went on to repeat what he just said to Thomas. It seems to Philip that really to see the Father might well be the solution. From Jesus' gentle rebuke, saying, "Don't you know me, Philip? Even after I've been among you for such a long time." Here, Jesus just mentioned a moment ago that by knowing him, they know the Father. So you see, Philip is really not a bright guy, a guy with limited knowledge. Frankly, being one of the disciples, he is expected to know better. But instead, he was looking for a shortcut. He doesn't want to go into something this complicated. Compared to Thomas, who didn't ask anything after the initial question, instead chose to point on the answer that Jesus gave. As we all know that later in the narrative, that this Thomas is also a man of science. He wants evidence, and he's a thinker. Philip, on the other hand, shows his ignorance by asking this question. So to summarize, Philip is not that smart, with little faith, no determination whatsoever, and has limited knowledge. He is far from being your typical disciple. So this is more or less what you would call an average guy, right? With the word average used in a rather negative connotation. So why is he a disciple? How can that be? Did Jesus make a mistake? And more importantly for us, what can we learn from this guy? What can we learn from this guy? To answer this question, we need to go back to the first Philip passage in John. So let's go back to the passage that we heard like earlier, chapter 1, 43 to 46. In John 1, we see Jesus came to Philip's hometown, found him, and called him to be his disciple. So let's read one more time. The next day, Jesus decided to leave for Galilee. Finding Philip, he said to him, "Follow me." Philip, like Andrew and Peter, was from the town of Bethsaida. Philip found Nathanael and told him, "We have found the one Moses wrote about in the law and about whom the prophets also wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph." "Nazareth, can anything good come from there?" Nathanael asked. "Come and see," said Philip. So what did Jesus see in Philip that we do not see? If you take a closer look to the passage, Philip is actually described as a pretty religious guy. Yes, this rather limited guy with little faith in Jesus was actually a pretty religious guy. Three things can be singled out here. In verse 45, we notice that the first thing he said to Nathanael, "We have found the one Moses wrote about in the law and about whom the prophets also wrote." To the people in the time of Jesus, the law and the prophets are what is roughly equivalent to the Old Testament today, so which is their Bible. So he is a guy who is familiar with his Bible. He knows his Bible. Like, how about us? Let me share with you a rather embarrassing experience of mine. I remember a long time ago, I was in this church workshop. I don't even remember what that workshop was about. But when the speaker asked us to turn to the letter of Jude, this one verse, you know what I asked? I asked the most obvious but also the dumbest question. Which chapter? Oh, no laugh, so you don't know what I'm talking about. Or you guys think this is not funny. As most of you know, the book got only one chapter. So I was definitely not like Philip. I don't know my Bible well at the time. So just in case, next time when someone asks you to turn to the book of Obadiah, 2 John, 3 John, the letter of Philemon, and the letter of Jude, don't ask which chapter. They all have only one chapter, okay? Philip is serious about his Bible because he said he found the one Moses and the prophets mentioned in the Bible. He is really serious about the Word of God, serious enough to spend time and effort to read the Word. The second thing that we need to take note about Philip is that when Philip came to his friend, to Nathanael, the first thing that he said to him is like, "We found him, we found him. We have found the one Moses wrote about in the law and about whom the prophets also wrote." I mean, how can his friend understand what he is talking about? From the conversation here, we can assume that this is actually a common topic that they talk about all the time. This shows that Philip and Nathanael are so enthusiastic about their own faith, their own religion. The hope of this Messiah is always in their conversation. It is what they talk about all the time. They always point on the one who is going to come and liberate them from Gentile oppression, the one who is going to bring salvation to the Jews. So this is what they talk about all the time. Their religion, their God, and their Messiah is really high on their priority of life. So you see, the things that you keep on mentioning to people, it's usually what occupying your mind at the time. So when you keep on talking about a singer, a game, or a TV show, or your work, or your friends, that's what occupying your mind. We need to ask ourselves, what sits in your mind? For Philip and Nathanael, it is the messianic hope. And finally, if you look at verse 46, when challenged by Nathanael, Philip is exactly who he is. He didn't argue because he's not good at it. And also, what Nathanael raises here is not a simple question. The town Nazareth is never mentioned in the entire Old Testament. It is not a big town in the minds of the Jews anyway. So here, as in chapter 6, he's confronted with a very difficult question. Just that this time he didn't back off, but demonstrates the perfect evangelical tactics. He told his friends three simple words: come and see. And of course, we know how the story goes, right? They both believe Jesus as the Messiah. So he got the perfect tactics for spreading the gospel. He just asked people to come and see. Today, we obviously do not have Jesus in person to show others, right? But what are we showing others when we invite them to our church? A nice building, some good-looking people, the way we sing, the way we talk, the way we treat people. What do we, when we ask them to come to church, what would they see? Christian love, Christian value. How about a God? Like, how do we show people our God today? What do we show people when we ask them to come and see? Philip has Jesus, and he's not afraid to ask people to come and see the Lord. So who is the real Philip is the question for today. The guy who loves his Bible and is pretty religious, or the guy who has little faith with no determination and kind of lazy? I suppose the answer is both. He is both the religious fanatic and the guy with little faith. He reads his Bible, but does not quite know his master. So you see, the key here is not whether Philip is a good disciple or a bad disciple. The key is that Jesus knows Philip very well and still chose him to be his disciple. So in verse 43, John says, Jesus decided to leave for Galilee. Jesus determined to go to this place and sought out Philip. He didn't just bump into him by accident. He was very determined to find him, to recruit him as his disciple. He came to him with a simple command, two words: follow me. Asking him to be a disciple for life, as if asking him to keep on following for the rest of his life. And Philip follows. But after what we have gone through just now, we might have a big question mark on Jesus' choice of Philip, right? Look, what is the responsibility of a disciple? It is a great responsibility, isn't it? If you are Jesus and you have to choose like 12 guys or 11 guys to be the foundation of the church, to be responsible for the teaching and mentoring the first Christians to build the church, who will you choose? We may go with 12 Peters, who is a go-getter. We may go with 12 Paul, who may have a PhD degree by today's standard. We may want to enlist people with great ability, just like the movie Ocean's 11, right? When the main character plans to rob three casinos at the same night, he found 10 very good professional thieves. You have the detonation expert, you have the expert with the cars, you have a professional pickpocket, and even an acrobat, right? But Philip? Why? What does this tell us about Jesus? I don't know about you, but this is actually a pretty comforting message. Jesus went all the way to find this rather limited man, this perfectly ordinary guy, and to enlist him in the apostle band. I don't know about you, but I found this very comforting. Jesus went all the way to find the limited, the ordinary, and sometimes even lazy fellow to be his disciple. We don't have to be the brightest and the smartest in order to become a disciple. There is more to it than just being smart or being cool or knowledgeable or famous or having a good voice or able to play three musical instruments. The average Joe can become a disciple of Jesus too. So before you jump into conclusion yourself and figure, well, I'm not this Philip, and this is hard for me to be a religious person and find time to study the Bible every day. I'd rather be this other Philip. I want to be the ordinary guy, the ordinary Christian, or the average Christian. Well, what I want to tell you today is not an either-or message. It's not an either-or kind of life. We're not talking about two Philips here. I'm not telling you that either you are a religious fellow or a faithless guy with limited ability. There is only one person we are talking about here today. The fanatic is also sometimes little in faith. The one who read and reread the Bible is also sometimes the man with limited abilities. He doesn't quite get it sometimes. The one with the perfect tactics to spread the gospel is also a guy who looks for shortcuts sometime. Philip are all these things. Nowhere does the Bible describe Philip as schizophrenic. He is a man with limited ability, little faith sometimes, and panic when confronted with a difficult question. But he also shows us that sometimes he is rather religious. We're not talking about Jekyll and Hyde here. I'm not talking about there is this epic battle of good and evil in your heart or in your head. I'm talking about the fact that we are all work in progress in Jesus' eyes, who calls us to be his disciple. We are all work in progress. He knows we have to work with the Spirit in this world to regenerate our hearts, to close ourselves with the new being, to win against the enemies, which includes our old self, the world, and the devil. He knows that we are not perfect until the final consummation, until the day he returns. We struggle between success and failure in discipleship. We need to struggle to find time and effort to become a disciple after his own heart. We need to sacrifice a lot to be more like him. In the journey of discipleship, he knows that sometimes we succeed and sometimes we fail. Sometimes it seems failure is the only outcome. Sometimes we do better, sometimes not quite so. He knows the life that we have in this world is an uphill battle for you and for me. He knows all these, and he still chooses us to be his disciple. His word to Philip is also the word to us. He asks us to follow him for life. No matter how good or bad you are right now, no matter whether you are a very super spiritual person or you are going downhill in your spiritual journey, Jesus came all the way to you and said this simple yet powerful words once again: follow me. Let's pray. Dear Lord Jesus, thank you for the story of Philip. Thank you for showing us that you didn't choose your disciples according to their appearance or according to their ability. Your call for discipleship is for every one of us. We thank you for letting us to be part of your kingdom advancement. Give us strength and courage to walk with you every day. Remind us that we're not alone in our spiritual journey. You know us. You know us better than we know ourselves. And you choose us. You chose us. Thank you. In your name. Amen.